This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20. Previously, TV Podcast Network.
We don't have a formula yet of who's going to be doing what, but everyone recognizes that we're following this thing till the end. We have to see where it goes.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 105 for the week of May 28th, 2018. Wow. I am podcast trying his hardest to look like a grown-up Harry Potter, David T. Cole, and I'm here with exasperated bureau chief Sarah D. Bunting.
Don't tweet that. Oh, man.
Nut graph nut, Tara Ariano.
Delicious!
And freelance Hellraiser, Mo Ryan.
I'm mad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another all-new episode of Extra Hot Great. We are joined this week by freelance Hellraiser and star of the Star Trek draft, Mo Ryan. Welcome back,
hey.
Mo.
Such a fond memory for me. I still contend that I made all the right choices and my team is perfect, so.
There were no winners in the Star Trek draft, except there was, and it was me.
Incorrect. Okay.
Well, I'm glad that I could unearth that old story and pick at that scab. We are actually here to talk about the creation of stories at the paper of record, the New York Times, as covered by Showtime's new four-part documentary series, The Fourth Estate. It is directed by Liz Garbus, who has done some of my favorite TV documentaries in the past, and my husband was walking around referring to this show as "There's Something Wrong with All the President's Men." But actually, it is, and yay, Dan, good job. But it is about the coverage of the first year of Trump's presidency, and not just Trumpy stuff, but other big stories that occurred in that year. I have watched all four episodes. It definitely hits that processy sweet spot for me. And Liz Garbus is an expert assembler, which sounds like faint praise, but for someone who watches as much non-fic TV as I do, is actually not. She knows build, and she's very good at documentary pacing. And I really enjoyed it while also finding it extremely frustrating to revisit some of these events in recent American history as a progressive. It was just like, oh God, like Bannon, really? We're going that close on Bannon? Could we maybe pull back camera two, please, if he's not going to pop that thing? Mo, what did you think of the build of it? And also, how did you feel about revisiting some of these stories in documentary form?
To some degree, I think actually this was in my review. It felt a little bit like a dutiful recap, not like an inspired recap. It was just like, remember that one time when Scaramucci was a thing for like 2 days? And so it was one of those reviews that was tough to write because, you know, I believe in the mission of journalism. Obviously, I think that the New York Times often does exemplary journalism. And yet, you know, as with anything that, you know, can be critiqued, you can love something and critique it, you know, in a fairly rigorous fashion. So for me, what was hard was pulling apart what is this show, what is this documentary highlighting or showing about the New York Times that frustrates me, and what's just frustrating about the documentary? And so those are two different things. I think overall, I think it's really hard to feel like it was a complete work. And obviously, you know, if you're covering an entire news organization for a year with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of employees, I'm not asking for it to be like fly on the wall of every single person in a rumpled button down shirt, because that would be excruciating because there are so many of them and they're mostly white. So, you know, I just felt like, why not die? I felt like it needed to be either a lot longer or a lot shorter. And I just couldn't decide which. It's like either drill down on following around Maggie Haberman, or, you know, maybe the investigations team in DC or what have you, or don't just give me, you know, 10 minutes of this person talking to Bannon, maybe give me more of, you know, or even 3 minutes usually is what it is. So I found that as someone who's, you know, I want it to be something that makes people care about journalism for sure. And I feel like that was the point. But there were, tell me if you guys agree, there were points at me that it felt like a corporate rah-rah film that you would see on a company retreat. It was like
For sure.
So in the bag, you know?
I mean, the fact that this thing was over 4 hours long and we get one scene of, you know, acknowledging the business fact of the situation of like the walkout of the copy editors, it's like that was one scene. You know, how can you tell that story of 2017 and 2018 of journalism of the most successful, probably, newspaper in the country? And that's then you give such short shrift to the business realities of what's going on, you know, behind all these stories. I found that actually kind of shocking.
Yeah, agreed. I found that it didn't go far enough. And it felt like it was a lot of what, and I think that like, while I respect the impulse to go cover the people who cover things that we all should care about or do care about, the way that news is gathered, it's not just that it's, you know, people staring at screens and drinking coffee, which is not, you know, highly dynamic, but it's also, you know, it's something that happens on Slack, on email, in Google Docs, in text chains, in phone calls that are not on screen. I mean, I think that a lot of how it all comes together, it's just training a camera on somebody. I don't know that that's the way to do it. I mean, if you were to tell me that someone like, say, Lawrence Wright had written a book about the first year of the New York Times in the age of Trump, I would have bought that book in a hot second, you know, because I think that people would be more willing to talk about how the sausage is made. This is a very, very glancing view for the most part of how the sausage is made, but that can be of interest to people. And I don't know how many of you guys saw the fourth episode, but I just thought that that one was on a different level. And it kind of, to me, felt like what they'd been wanting to do all along, they kind of got there more with that one.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I watched it. It's also
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult, like acknowledging just the difficulties of like, how do you sort of animate both literally and figuratively the process of news gathering? That I think that that's something that without going into this, like, what's his name? Supersize Me guy who tends to get a little
Morgan Spurlock.
Yes, thank you. Who tends to get a little, excessively cutesy and, Schoolhouse Rock with the animations, but at least there's like, at least there is that visual interest, and at least there is that, like, get one of the, I don't know, get the creator of Sherlock to sort of figure out how you get texts and Slack and stuff on screen and make it part of the narrative. Because Mo, I think you're exactly right that there's this, there's like a whole talking head about how the newsroom is not the same as it was in the Watergate era, and they have to keep up with that. But then at the same time, they're just sort of pointing a camera at what people are doing, like offline only. So
they're doing that so much. I wonder what's in that text. Well, we'll never know. I guess it was important. And she's talking, you know, Maggie Haberman's driving along, talking to a source like, oh, this is happening today. we don't know who that is. And there is an interesting story to be told, I think, on how do you maintain access to sources and do tough reporting. That doesn't get answered, you know, and I think I really think that there's this thing that happens with people who work at the New York Times and with other high profile. Look, I mean, as three of us are ladies who've been on the internet a long time, we know what it's like to feel attacked. But people, there is a mentality abroad sometimes, and sometimes you see it reflected from places like the New York Times. If all criticism is, if some criticism is extreme, then all criticism is invalid. No, that's not true at all. And I just feel like, wow, there's a story in the fact that every time there's a meeting, most of the people are white. There's two separate meetings. I didn't get into this in my review. There's at least two or three meetings, definitely two, where there are, I think it's majority men in the meeting, majority white people for sure. But there's two meetings in which there are women present. The men talk almost all the time. And like, this is a real thing that happens in the world. And it's almost like you get these tantalizing glimpses of things that just the documentary just kind of speeds right by. I don't know.
The one thing I thought about the show as a whole is I kept on asking the question, like, why is this coming out now? Like, we are 1 year into it, and maybe it speaks to what Mo was saying originally. Like, it seemed sort of half-baked in the ways that you wanted it to be better. Like, you wanted it to be either more of an indictment of news gathering in the age of Trump, if you're, like, left, very left-minded, or sort of more of a fly-on-the-wall peek at what's actually going on in the newsroom. You don't really get either. One is circumstance of the real world. One is, you know, at the feet of the documentarians. But I think this might have been a better series if they sort of let it go on and sort of push for better access. And maybe this is something that comes out next year. Like, when the credits came up, like, the promise of the credits and the music and the tone of the credits is not evident in the show. Like, that seemed like two different vibes. It was pretty rah-rah-y in the actual documentary, and the credits seemed to make me think that this was going to be something dirty. And it wasn't really dirty. It was actually pretty clean.
Well, Trent Reznor. Was anyone else frustrated by the fact that, I mean, there is like sort of a semi-focus on Maggie Haberman for a while. And then there are a couple of sequences in which reporters are shown interviewing people in MAGA hats. And I just felt that it felt like between when all of this was filmed and now, like, as we record this, it's a Tuesday, but over the last couple of days, there's been kind of this nonstop hammering, at least on Twitter, of Maggie Haberman splitting hairs on the definition of lying. And
which is a story point in episode four, too, where they sort of discuss, like, what, how do we determine what rises to the level of something we can reasonably call a lie when everything is a lie? You know what I mean? Like, and I empathize with that from the outside. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I was telling Dave about Daniel Dale of the Star, the Toronto Star, whose whole thing kind of is like keeping track of every lie and not letting any of them get by. And so that, that was frustrating to me this weekend too, of course, with Maggie Haberman, who's like, since the time that this at least started filming, I'm sure has really lost a lot of her luster. You know, probably still a great reporter, but at least on Twitter, like a less and less pleasant follow. I mean, starting well before the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but that was sort of where it started going downhill for her, where she should maybe also have her Twitter account go dormant a la Glenn Thrush, although his didn't stay dormant either. But
there's one time. So I think it's sort of a microcosm, which I think it was meant to be, of traditional journalism wasn't made for this kind of deliberate warping of reality, essentially, and truth. So I think it was an interesting time to be in a major league newsroom. But there's I won't name the reporter, because like, if you watch the whole thing, you'll find out. But there's one reporter who says, "Oh, I don't vote because I don't want to have a dog in this hunt." And
yes,
and I'm like, okay, but Do you believe in the norms of a civilized society?
Yeah.
Like, at some point, do you, like, it, that's, it, I don't, I just feel like there's this DC press pack mentality of, like, well, we have to give both sides, which, you know, makes me want to, like, shove a spike into my head. And, you know, as a reporter, I've certainly been there and having to get the side of someone, you know, whoever I'm covering and put that in the story and all that. But no matter what those views were, but, you know, I think at a certain point, the New York Times is, it's, I mean, maybe this is one way in which it's good. It does show it to be this kind of very slow moving battleship. And when, I don't know that any organization is made for this flood the zone, warp reality time.
Yeah.
I just don't know that she examined or delved into that nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially since the major thrust of it was them trying to adapt to an online world, and
right.
the online world that moves so fast is now even like it's hypercharged in an era where Trump is just tweeting, you know, random bullshit every morning. And
right.
they're not really reacting to that in a meaningful way. Like, they're reacting to the speed of everything, but they're not reacting to the topsy-turviness of it. And I don't think they really do a good job challenging the New York Times on that in this documentary.
Yeah, I wish they'd spent more time. Like, I thought they gave a good sense of what it was like for some of these reporters to just be faced with, like, the chaos that Trump creates in terms of just your basic deadlines, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the veritable torrent of material that would be like a 56-point headline in any other era, but it's like just the same volume of colluding horseshit every day. Spoiler on my political views, I guess. But it's like, I wish they'd just sat with that part of it more, and B, been a little less willing to let the Times do that, like, Timesy thing it does. And you've seen this in previous documentaries, with the exception of the late great David Carr cutting his eyes at the camera and being like, whatever, it's the Times, of like being very sort of like performatively self inspecting about stuff like Glenn Thrush, and then quite pleased with where they come out on it. And that meeting, and that meeting where, you know, Dean is like, so how does everyone feel about this decision? Like, are you fucking kidding? You're the big boss. What are they going to say on a conference call that's being recorded by documentary cameras?
Exactly.
You should have fired his grabby ass. Like, someone should have
said that specifically in my review. No woman speaks up on that call. I mean, honestly, it was a dude who said, why didn't you fire him? And I'm not making a case for either of those things right now. I'm just saying people, you know, there's this thing that people say sometimes, like, well, I guess if I'm pissing off all sides, I'm doing something right.
Yeah.
Or counterpoint, if you're pissing off all sides, maybe you're making a mistake.
Right.
You know, I mean, the Times, it's like almost like, especially the Times has this, like, this is clearly an attempt to open the doors, make people care about the Times, when, you know, quite, you know, prominently sort of had this attitude of, we are the New York Times. We are going to come down from our mountaintop and deign to tell you what the news is. And so it's a very uncomfortable fit, because do people scrutinize and criticize the Times, especially in a very heightened era, especially for certain things over and over? Yes. Could that be for valid reasons? I think the thing about the New York Times is it's kind of like the two EPs of Game of Thrones. They have changed based on public pressure. Will they ever admit it? Nope.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't need a whole other, like, please let us read you our, like, rehab journal process that followed Jason Blair. Like, not that that wasn't necessary, but I don't need to see you pulling on your big boy pants. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was frustrating to me, too, is that there was so little kind of, I mean, for all the introspection that was happening, there was very little interrogation of, like, what stories get primacy. And I, of course, grant, part of that is the fire hose of bullshit that we are all being sprayed with constantly.
Yeah.
But what's frustrating to me is that so much of this and so much of the coverage in the Times is focused on Russia, duh, and you know, related scandalous things. In episode 4, we get up to Stormy Daniels, but that, you know, they don't really get that far into it because it's, you know, it ends around a month ago, almost exactly. I think, like, I think the last dateline we see is mid-April, maybe. But the we get sort of glimpses through it of other stories that people are trying to do with regard to policy. Like in episode 2, we spend a little bit of time with Eric Lipton, where he's saying, I want to do a series about regulations that are being rescinded or changed or whatever. And one of his editors in this meeting is like, it's very expected for the Times to do a series on that where Donald Trump is the villain.
We don't want to be typecast. That was the word he used, like, typecast.
Exactly. But it's like, that's the objective reality.
You don't, and also, you don't want to be typecast as the New York Times?
Right. Yeah.
What would you like to be typecast as instead?
And that's the whole both sidesism that I like. I just actually now I just call it both sidesism because it's some kind of religion for certain people and powerful.
Yeah.
The both sidesism gets imposed in those middle layers of management. It's not, I mean, maybe Elizabeth Boumiller is doing it too. I think she sort of came up through the DC reporting structures. So there's that. But like, there's this amorphous middle where people like that, I think the editor's name was Dean Murphy, you mm-hmm. don't see them. You don't see them interacting with reporters very rarely. They'll maybe have a sentence here or there. But the mindset of the people in middle management at the New York Times is where you get this thing where, like, here's something I will say again, personal opinion. In the year of the election, Hillary Clinton's email server stuff was covered as much as breaking the norms of civil society again and again, 15 mm-hmm. times a day by Donald Trump. They were given equal weight. This is me as a subscriber. Right. This is just me as a human being saying these two things were given equal weight. And I think that that's an enormous blind spot for somewhere like the Times. And I think that the people at the middle layers are probably, you know, to some degree following what the top editors want, or to a great degree. But that's where that kind of insane imbalance happens.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of comment that guy made that makes it very apparent. But as we've been talking about, like, this documentary is not the one that's going to push back on that or really interrogate it.
Right. But that's a blind spot. Again, that's a blind spot of its of the documentary's portrayal of how much any kind of mainstream news source like this is going to naturally be trying to preserve power, despite mm-hmm. what journalism is supposed to be doing for business reasons. Like, one of the biggest things that the Times has been criticized for over the past year is the people that they're hiring for their opinion pages. And I know this is about the reporting and not the opinion, but it's like, that's a business decision too. And that doesn't come up in this documentary at all. Like, we don't see Bret Stephens' names or like any of the other crazy right-wing people that when they get this huge platform, you know, people who don't want to read about climate change denialism are canceling the subscriptions that they dutifully bought right after the election to support journalism. You know what I mean? Like, this is another big blind spot I felt it had.
Also, the Me Too ladies are on screen for maybe what, 10 seconds?
Yeah. Well, and then again, I'm a Roy Jones supporter. We got government funding, but we'd still vote for Trump because he's right. Government funding needs to be cut. People like look at us not shaming these stooges. Like, okay, good for you.
Yeah, but the New York Times just has like a really, like, the end of the series for me was like such a blind spot on both sides. I'll just play the clip.
The day in and day out attacks on us that hurts us.
Oh, God.
But this has happened in history during the civil rights movement in Vietnam. A lot of people attacked news organizations like the New York Times, called them bad, evil, outside agitators. All I can say is those guys are gone. And the New York Times is still here.
This is just after, at least in the documentary, they presented as just after the Pulitzer Prize reveal. The problem with that is for the New York Times to not really acknowledge that these people, as he says, is like they exist on a continuum. They never left. They were never vanquished.
Yeah. You know,
it's, yeah. it's, they were half of America then, they're half of America now.
And yeah. Like, death comes for us all. Good point, I guess.
Present yourself as a warrior against this movement. And then you watch the rest of the documentary. You're like, well, you know, did you really do that? It's just like they really do seem to have a big blind spot here. And for the documentarians to present this without irony at the end of it as yes. the capper to getting the Pulitzer is like, wow. Like what? That was the end? Yeah. Just like shot themselves in the yeah. foot. It was like.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that the filmmakers weren't kind of trolling the executive editor throughout. Yeah. Like he so seldom appeared in a good light. Maybe that's just us, but it's like, ooh, like I don't envy his position, but I'm not entirely sure that wasn't sort of intentionally letting him hoist himself with his own out of touch petard. The piano music was really a lot though. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on,
if man. He's trying to present himself as a revolutionary, like we do not really see that. That's not the story that I feel is being told to us or that is accurate either. Anyway,
I feel like it pretty much buys into the times as noble quest pretty mm-hmm. hardcore.
And yeah, I think you're right.
I just don't know that like there was an earlier sequence in the first episode where A.G. Sulzberger's, whatever Sulzberger's is publisher now, there's like a whole brief segment where it's like, we're talking to A.G. Sulzberger and he's the new Young Turk, blah, 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 blah. And then he's like, well, as a family institution, we think in decades. And I'm like, if I was at a work retreat and they were literally showing this, you know, for like rah, rah team, we're great. I would be like, where's the alcohol?
Yeah.
I'm not saying be cynical about the news, but I'm just saying that the Times does not, like a lot of journalism comes down on the side of both sides-ism because it's an evasion. Yes, there are different kinds of stories and different approaches you can take, but at a certain point, are you pro the norms of a civil society that follows the rule of law? Or are you anti that?
Right.
Like, I feel like they don't want to actually have to say what they're about or what they believe in. As a democratic society, we feel like the role of the press is important and we will own this, this, and this as our core values. Okay, we'll just say it. Just own it. But they just sort of always want to have the credit for what they do right and never really engage with what annoys people about
And
that,
they doubled yeah. down on the frustration by treating the absurdity of the current administration as journalistic sport, where yes. they're like, well, it certainly is a great time to be a journalist. This is crazy.
I'm an
like,
adrenaline junkie.
What a great story. Trump's about yeah. to, like, you know, destroy some other pillar of civilization.
Right.
You know, like the fact that they take sort of some glee in it, you know, is disconcerting for those that want their reporting to have more teeth. It doesn't seem mm-hmm. like some of them are in it for the right reasons.
There's a compartmentalizing that happens that I guess I just sort of, it just depends on where you are at as a human being. But there's a reporter, Jeremy Peters, and you see him like, oh, I've been covering Breitbart since like 2010 and I've known Bannon for a while and I wrote Andrew Breitbart's Obit, and so he thinks I'm a, you know, like I will take his. So you see him sitting down with him, talking to him, meeting him at a rally, all this kind of stuff. And you also see that he's a gay man and he's married. And he, but then it's like minutes later, you see him kind of like shooting the breeze with Bannon about a book deal that he got to cover all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, I don't like, I guess people compartmentalize differently. I find that just to be so chill about being at a rally for Roy Moore mm-hmm. and hanging with Bannon, these people just, they represent a threat to all of us, including, and as I would say almost especially you, but
yeah.
I guess get that book deal.
I mean, that was the thing about it too, where he says in that segment, like you hear his voiceover saying like Bannon goes out on stage and calls the press like the enemy of the people or whatever the fuck he says. And then he's like, and I was there as his invited guest. So it's like, okay, well then what is your responsibility as a reporter? Like, you know, do you maybe not accept that invitation? And again, it comes back to the question of like, what, how, how important is it to preserve your access above all else versus telling a story in a really adversarial way? I mean,
maybe that's where this documentary kind of ran into a problem on a meta level,
right?
Is that they didn't want to, they weren't necessarily pushing where they could have because they did want that access. Mm-hmm. And maybe that
that's
was
really
the
true.
Agreement.
Yeah. But it results in a different kind of story than if you were following an independent alt weekly or something else that doesn't have this many established reporters who, as we said earlier, a lot of the time we're just watching them sit at their desk waiting for a source to call them back or, leak something to them, which is, not as cinematic. All of that said, it was fascinating to watch. I didn't regret watching it. I just, you have to go into it being very aware of the stories that are specifically not being told to you as a viewer of this product. That's all. I mean, which is true of everything, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worthwhile in that, we've had a spirited discussion about it and it was sometimes frustrating is not bad. It's put together well. It's just it can be disappointing, but is that disappointing because of the film itself, the construction of it, or is it disappointing because the subjects of it are behaving in ways that we feel are not up to snuff and they're not being pushed on that? So, I mean, either way, I definitely was interested the whole time.
Yep, me too.
I thought it really got better as it went, but it felt like that sort of Netflix drama that kind of wanders around for four episodes. And it's like, oh, how about this? And you're like, yes, this pace is better. This feels like you're following things a little more deeply. It just was a little bloated and all over the map. At certain points, it clicks into focus. But I'll just throw out one last comment because I'm sure we're probably wrapping up soon. But early on, Dean Becquet says, well, we just realized we weren't really in touch with America. And that makes me kind of melt my brain because what that is code for is that we were not in touch enough with the resentful white working class that went for Trump. When in fact, there were a lot of people who voted other ways that you weren't in touch with and apparently do not care at all if you are still in touch with, because the labor movement is rising in a huge way in this country. And
does not come up in this documentary at all. Zero teacher strikes are mentioned.
The working class as a whole, this whole canard that, and I realized that maybe some of this stuff came out after the time frame of when she was filming folks. But it's let's go visit, the rural heartland. The rural heartland is full of more than just, lower middle class white people. There's all sorts of people out there. And I'm not saying that the Times didn't do that, but the feature, that at this point to see someone on a road trip visiting these people who voted for Trump, we've now had that piece in our face for a solid year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I just was that was one of the moments in the documentary where I was and stab me, let me die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, from one modern tragedy to the next.
Nice segue.
Well, we are gathered here to mark the passing of someone who was very important to us, my DVR. This DVR, a DirecTV Genie, first came into our lives 5 years ago. We were living in Los Angeles when Time Warner abruptly stopped carrying the East Coast feeds for some of its cable networks. Wait to watch Mad Men at 10 p.m. Pacific? I would have rather died. DirecTV had East Coast feeds for all of its cable networks, so we switched. And the Genie storage capacity was beyond anything I'd ever known, and I started filling it. Sometimes with stuff I knew in my heart of hearts I was never going to be in the right mood to watch, but I loved the person I thought I might eventually be when I would set the DVR to record an episode of Frontline that was 2 hours long, entirely subtitled, and extremely depressing. And sometimes I filled it with TV episodes I could easily access via one of the many streaming services I also pay for. Yes, the entire pre-revival series run of Roseanne was available on Amazon Prime, but I didn't have an Apple TV in my office. I had to record its hundreds of episodes when they aired in syndication to play when there was nothing else on. And I truly thought the Genie and I would spend the rest of our lives together. I never planned for a future in which we wouldn't. But then, We rented a bright, sunny house in Austin, its common areas lousy with windows. So many, in fact, that there was pretty much only one wall against which to put our big TV so that we could arrange our living room furniture around it. And on the other side of that wall was a bathroom. No exterior wall meant we had to switch to wireless receivers. That's right, switch. DirecTV would come install a wireless genie, but they would also take our old wired genie away, and with it all the shows and movies that had filled it to 68% capacity. That actually estimate might be low. It's never easy to say goodbye to a friend, but it's especially hard to part ways from one who's given so much, demanding nothing in return. In our 5 years together, my old genie granted all my wishes, all except my last wish that it transfer its memories to my new genie, but I will treasure my memories of the good times we had. R.I.P.
It is time to go around the dial. Tara, you're up first.
Okay, well, I finally got to, because I was away from the DVR, and we got the Apple TV from Hawaii that had the CW app. I was able to watch the last two episodes of Jane the Virgin, season 4. Wow, what a great ending to the season. Mo, I know you watch it too, and this was so good. The way that they've covered Ciamara's cancer has been, it felt extremely true to me the whole way through. She got a late in her treatment cancer buddy played by the great Amy Brenneman, and of course she's a good friend to her and gives her weed brownies and then dies because it's a very sad show sometimes. And the other thing that I appreciate is that it does not idealize parenting at all. Mateo, Jane, and Raphael's son is a real shithead sometimes in the way that actual 4, 5, 6-year-old kids are. Like when he doesn't listen and he knocks something over at the flea market and it costs $4,000. You have to pay the guy back for the clock that your stupid kid broke. And also that he does need to learn to follow rules, like not touching the stove. And I appreciate that it because it's a multi-generational show and that's something that's built into its DNA, as it were, that they do also explore clashes between younger parents and older grandparents, which happens sometimes with Alba, Jane's grandmother, and Jane and Raphael, and how they choose to discipline Mateo or not, i.e. the grandma wants to spank and they don't, and it's an issue. But they don't just sweep it under the rug. Like, it gets dealt with. Everybody's feelings are treated seriously. And in Alba's case, you know, they let her sort of talk about how it's important to her to enforce the rules that she set because she feels like she's being kind of shunted off as she gets older. And that felt very real to me too. And, also Raphael at the end of the second last episode, getting invited to hang out with Jane and Alba in bed and just like sit and shoot the breeze, I thought was very sweet. Cause that's always been something that was just for the Villanueva women. So I thought that was a huge breakthrough for his character. In terms of the big soapy cliffhanger at the end of the finale, I mean, I don't know how they write this one, they themselves out of this one. I guess now since it aired like 2 months ago, I can say that Michael is not dead as we have thought he was for years now. Since this is going to be the final season, I assume that they have thought this through, and I trust them at this point, even with the soapier stuff that I find less interesting, to get themselves out of it and end the series in a satisfying way. So great season 4, still a wonderful show. I love it so much. And for my plug, Maureen Ryan and I are going to be on a panel together at the ATX Festival. It's next week now. Oh my God, it's so soon. Mo, we're going to be debating. Are you prepared?
So prepared. I mean, I will not definitely be prepping on the plane out there to Austin at all. I'll be super prepared before that.
No, me neither. I've got it well in hand. I also have been invited since the last time I brought up the festival. Once again, the ATX Festival here in Austin, Texas. It's June 7th to 10th, I believe. I also am going to be moderating a panel about composing music for television featuring WG Snuffy Walden. And I'm freaking out about it because he's only a legend. So if you're coming to ATX, make sure to look up where both Maureen and I are. What other panels are you going to be on, Mo?
I am super excited because I'm going to be moderating One Day at a Time, which we will be revisiting in this podcast. Yes. So that's a little bit of foreshadowing. Well done, me. there's also a panel on fandom and, you know, kind of like how fan relationships work in the age of social media. There's one, Winona Earp, which, you know, again, I will be plugging on this podcast because I have a like maximum 2-track mind. and there's one panel I'm excited about that'll be about power dynamics in Hollywood and how, you know, I actually think, you know, it's interesting to me when people are like, well, the Me Too era is just about like, blah, 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 like, you know, stringing people up and blah, blah. And I'm like, you know, I think actually people have been fairly nuanced about how they describe, you know, situations and the continuum of behaviors and whatnot. But there's also an enormous complexity to power relationships at any workplace. But in Hollywood, they're especially bananas. So I think that'll be an interesting panel. Hopefully we'll see.
Awesome. And also my final Americans recap drops as you hear this podcast, if you listen to it the day it comes out, that will drop tonight, the very last one and the longest one that I've written in a real long time. It's a big, big episode. So I was very satisfied by it, as we mentioned last week. So check that out at previously.tv.
All right, Mo, what do you got?
I am going to hype the bejeebus out of a double bill, which has been one of my favorite double bills for a couple years now. On Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi is obviously has lots of different shows, but the double bill that I really like the most, it consists of Killjoys and Winona Earp. It's coming back July 20th. It used to be on a bill with a show called Dark Matter, which I also watched because I will watch anything with a spaceship. You could make literally the world's most terrible show and I will watch it. And I am, of course, referring to Gene Roddenberry's, what was it? Something Earth.
Oh, Destiny.
Planet Earth.
Destiny.
It was very bad. It was very in some show that I think Kevin Sorbo created. I have no pride, no shame. Anyway, Dark Matter, which was a pretty good show, is no longer with us. But Winona Earp and Killjoys are, and I'm very, very happy. I think that if you like escapist genre programming, these are shows that really kind of deliver on that front. And I think, you know, I've recommended Winona Earp a lot. It definitely has some wobbles to get past early in its first season. I think it's purely worth it. It turns into a very, very sort of Buffy-esque, very well-paced narrative, especially the last like third of the season or so. And that's not to say that the first season is bad. I just think that they're trying to like figure out what they're good at. And there are moments that are very over the top. And sometimes there is a much more, you know, granular emotional tone. So they figure out how to balance those things really well, I think, in the first season. And then in the second season, the first season is on Netflix. The second season will be joining it on Netflix, I believe, in early June. So you should have a really fun binge if you haven't seen either. The second season was just a whole bunch of fun. You know, a lot of times I think that the second season of a show is really the, like, you know, the first season's the shakedown cruise. The second season is like, okay, do they have this? To me, that was a case where they absolutely have it. And if you like the last like 4 or 5 episodes of season one, then you're just going to really, really enjoy season two. Both shows are made in Canada for about $4 per episode.
And classic sci-fi.
That's how it works.
Shows, exactly. Like, but they both have female showrunners. I think that that's very obvious. They, like there's just a number of things that they don't do. And I think that's almost something I look toward more these days. Like what, not just, do you supply good characters and, you know, a fun kind of chronicle that's happening, but what, you know, what are you just avoiding? Because I'm tired and I just don't have mental space for certain cliches. But, Emily Andras is a really, kick-ass showrunner. She's really aware. There's a very high profile, two women in the show. The show kind of came up right around in 2016 when a lot of, you know, barrier gaze tropes were being decried, you know, quite rightly. And so it is a show in which people can be in danger and are in danger. But, you know, there's an awareness of how important that relationship is to the queer community. The fandom is really nice in my experience. It's a bunch of like, you know, just really friendly, fun people that have never swarmed me for reasons that I found tiresome. So well done, fandom. And Killjoys, I mean, I feel like the fandom of Winona Earp, it's about, by the way, I should tell you what it's about. It's about a woman who's essentially a chosen one. She has a special pistol that she uses to put down revenants that haunt this one particular town. It's called the Ghost River Triangle. The town is within that. And she is like the heir to Wyatt Earp. And so she has to kind of put down these revenants, and there's this band of friends and lovers and associates and townsfolk that kind of band together around her. And so it's this crazy, like, horror Western shot on the, you know, the prairies of around Calgary. Every winter they shoot this show and everyone looks so cold. It's like Fargo, but like, what if it was super fun? So I enjoyed that premise a lot, and the way they executed it is very fun. A lot of witty dialogue and sort of stuff like that. So Killjoys is, I think, has a lower profile. Winona Earp, I feel like you can't avoid knowing about it if you're on social media because the fans are very engaged. And I think Killjoys has engaged fans too, but it's never really quite broken through. It's just a really good space show about space bounty hunters. It's very political in that it's about like how these people in this one corner of space called the Quad are being oppressed by these, you know, wealthy families that kind of call all the shots. But it's one of my major life beliefs that just saying the word space bounty hunters can like lift your day and lift your spirit. So there's three main characters. There's Dutch, who has kind of like this special destiny, played by Hannah John Kamen. I think it's important and interesting and cool that this kick-ass space bounty hunter hero is a black woman. So that's cool. Her two kind of second in commands on her ship are two brothers, and they goof around a lot and have fun and have crushes or go hang out in a bar where a lot of the rebels hang out. So it's very much got a kind of almost, you know, it's almost like she's Han Solo and they're her Chewbacca's or something like that. It's a lot of heists of the week and adventures of the week and, you know, crazy space pirate of the week. So I just really think that supplying a show with reasonably good character development, reasonably fun stories, and just quite good escapism is actually a lot harder than it looks. And I think too many grim, dark shows are just grim, dark, and are boring and somehow get more prestigious, I don't know, shout outs in the media because we're supposed to find them more interesting. But I don't. So I really like these two shows. They come back July 20th on Sci-Fi. You don't necessarily, you can watch Winona Earp, the first two seasons on Netflix, especially as of early June. They'll both be there. Unfortunately, Killjoys, I think one of the things holding it back is there's not a streaming platform at the moment. You can watch it on Sci-Fi's app, which I will definitely not call garbage, but I could call it that, but which I will say it's not ideal to watch it with all the ads and everything. But if you were to, say, give yourself the gift of Killjoys or buy a couple and see if you like it, and then buy the rest because you are going to binge on it forever, that would be not a terrible idea.
Earth Final Conflict was the show.
That was it.
Yes.
And I did have the self-respect to not watch the whole thing, but I watched way too much of it. And by way too much, I mean more than five minutes.
Also from Canada. So, you know.
Sorry.
So we heard about your ATX. Big, anything else to plug?
I've got a bunch of like other podcasts I was on. If you at all enjoy podcasts, which you probably do if you're listening to this one, I was on the Tom and Lorenzo podcast recently, and that was super fun. So go check them. Their podcast is super great and fun, and I enjoy that quite a bit. So I'm also allegedly writing a book. So like, you know, decades from now, look for that in your bookstore. It's going to be about how television affected me as a woman, as a human, and as a critic, and why that matters. So awesome. We'll see. We'll see if I can actually pull that off. We'll see. Thanks.
Since we're on the Showtime documentary tip, I'm going to talk about Love Means Zero, which is a tennis pun. It tells the story of celebrated yet controversial tennis coach Nick Bollettieri and explores the cost of his all-consuming drive for greatness. except it doesn't exactly do that. This will air June 23rd on Showtime, nestled in between the French Open and Wimbledon. And it was an entertaining enough hour and a half visually that I sort of didn't really notice until the end how frustratingly thin it is. For even a four times a year tennis fan, it's disappointing how little tennis is in this, how little analysis of Bollettieri as a coach. What it's really about is the surrogate father-son love story, which curdled between Bollettieri and Andre Agassi. And if you wonder why filmmaker Jason Cohn didn't just call it Nick and Andre, it's probably because Agassi declined to participate in the documentary at all. And that could be worked around. Certainly Cohn tries. He gets interviews with Jim, number two son, Courier, and Carling Bassett, and other favorites and lesser lights out of the tennis academy. But there's nothing on Bollettieri's style of instruction. There's nothing on why Agassi invested so strongly in this quasi-paternal relationship, or why Bollettieri broke it off by FedEx letter. Once that happens, it just kind of trails off to the end. Until Bollettieri reads an open letter from Agassi's memoir to Bollettieri and like cries a little bit. We could have used, I don't know, even one line from someone theorizing on why Bollettieri might have kicked Kathleen Horvath out of the academy to focus on Carling Bassett. Or, I don't know, let's talk about how Carling Bassett ended up her tennis career, or on the eating disorder she herself brings up that's not followed up on. I was looking around online while I was watching this all. I can't believe this topic was never even a short on 30 for 30, because it seems like a total natural. But after a few minutes, you realize that ESPN would have been like, one half of your central narrative will not sit for you. Pitch rejected. Anyway, if you want to marvel at how disgusting everyone looked in the late 80s and early 90s on the tennis court, it's a pretty good sit, but you'll be much more frustrated by what isn't there than by what is. I do think that Cohn is a good assembler, like I said about Garbus before. I think that he has a good 30 for 30 in him, or a, you know, movie about something. There's just not enough to Love Means Zero to bother with it, I would say.
It taught me that Carling Bassett is a person and not, as I had thought until this moment, a beer. So that's something.
I actually remember her name. I was a huge tennis nerd in the 70s and 80s, and I watched a ton of tennis. And the whole, this is a fascinating topic to me, but it feels like they didn't really get all the way there.
Yeah, there are 30 for 30s on tennis, not annoyingly the Martina and Chrissy one, but any of the 30 for 30s are a better use of one's time and should be available on the ESPN app. For my plug, our esteemed colleague Linda Holmes has invited me onto this week's Pop Culture Happy Hour to talk about Law and Order.
Thank God.
I know, finally. There will also be a lengthy sidebar by me and Linda about SVU and it makes us want to stab ourselves in the eye. How I'm going to get through that without swearing, because Pop Culture Happy Hour is a family program. I'm sure I don't know. I think the producer is probably going to get carpal tunnel pressing the mute button. but anyway, that should be in your podcast apps this week. I will be on Pop Culture Happy Hour talking about Law and Order and things that make me actually happy.
Yay.
It is time for the canon. Mo Ryan is submitting this week as a prelude to her ATX moderating duties. take it away, Mo.
Hey, so no pressure. I'm just trying to formulate a canon entry that will sort of be on the level of this show, which this won't be. Let's just put that expectation to bed now. One Day at a Time is a really, really good show, and Netflix gave us all a lot of anxiety earlier in the year when the show finished. It dropped the whole season at once, but the whole second season was quite strong. The season finale in particular was fantastic, I thought. And then they waited a long time. It took their sweet time in renewing the show, which they finally did. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
But it would have been a dagger to my heart in so many ways if One Day at a Time, the new version of the Norman Lear show from back in the day, had not returned, it would have been a nightmare, because here's a show essentially doing everything right. And I think, you know, sometimes Netflix really leans into its image as the disruptor, and we do everything because we want to, and we don't have to play by the rules. But, you know, the rules of television used to be that you were a good show that did everything right, and then you got canceled. So I wanted them to rewrite that script, and fortunately they did. And it's interesting, I was thinking about this canon entry over the weekend, and I was thinking it's unusual to want to canonize an episode of a show that is still ongoing, a show that only has had two seasons. Those seasons have only had 13 episodes each. So we're not talking about, you know, a show that had even 100 episodes. So far, it's only had 26. And this episode in particular, the one that I want to nominate, Not Yet, is a really unusual structure. And it's extremely unusual for this show and for multicam sitcoms, for any sitcom, really. I think it's got a very strange structure. So why this episode? Well, I think, to me, it's a culmination of everything that we have learned about these characters. And it's an incredibly beautiful, heart-wrenching, romantic, sad, and funny, deeply funny at times, payoff to two seasons of having watched this show. And the script by Mike Royce and Gloria Calderon-Kellett, the two showrunners, is just so beautifully nuanced and yet takes on these really heavy, difficult things. And so one thing I want to say, if you're going to jump off this segment because you just don't care about comedies or you don't think this comedy is your jam, the reason I'll tell you it could be your jam is because I'm not really a huge fan of multicam sitcoms. I mean, I can be. I think in the main, they're just kind of generally done in a fairly lazy, you know, way that's very predictable. The rhythms are very predictable and they can be very pleasingly, you know, familiar, or they can just be kind of rote. And so I think a lot of times they're not really my cup of tea, but we've had some recently that have been outstanding. The Carmichael Show was really good, had a short run, was kind of under the radar, but did a similar thing to a lot of the better comedies these days, which is take some social issues or a social issue and examine them from all perspective within that very familiar sitcom, you know, multicam sitcom format, and have an intelligence and a perception of what matters in these issues while not getting too heavy or too weighted down by these topics. So One Day at a Time does that. I think for the most part, it does that very adeptly. This really wasn't necessarily an issue episode of the show. It was, but it was, it had some familiar elements. It was essentially a series of monologues, and it was also something, you know, some forms were employed that we're quite used to. You know, monologues themselves are not unfamiliar in TV. And sometimes, you know, there was an episode of Underground last year that was just essentially a monologue by Aisha Harris's character, Harriet Tubman. So this is, it's a break from how they normally do things. But the idea of a series of characters giving monologues is not all that foreign. And what I like about how they did it here was they made it to me like a, like music. It was like a verse, chorus, verse structure. So you would have a character's monologues, but then you would get a break. You'd get a release from that. There would be, you know, a priest coming in and there would be a funny exorcist joke, or there would be a nurse coming in and they would kind of rag on him and that would be funny. So the premise of the episode is that Lydia, the grandmother of the family and the greatest character, one of the greatest characters on television right now, played by the incredible Rita Moreno. She's in the hospital. She's had a procedure. She's in a coma. They don't know when she'll wake up. And the previous episode ended on a cliffhanger with her being ill. And so this coma is kind of the premise for the episode. And kudos to Rita Moreno for going probably multiple days of shooting, or at least one day of shooting, lying down in a hospital bed, looking like she was in a coma. That cannot have been easy. I know that it sounds like an easy job. It's really not, because you have to give, you know, complete focus to that person who's in the bed. That person in the bed has to maintain complete focus. So it starts out with, each character goes in and has a little bit of alone time with her. And so the first one is Alex. And what I love about the structure of the episode and how they play it out is that for every character, the connection or the monologue is based on that relationship. So Alex And Lydia loved to watch telenovelas. He does her nails. They talk about TV. He talks about the family going to church that day. So it's very much within the arena of how they relate to each other and their special relationship. So then Dr. Berkowitz comes in, and he's beautiful and wonderful. And he makes, you know, this kind of lovely attempt to, you know, sort of just relate how much he cares about Lydia to her and how much he, you know, how much the connection between them matters. And it's very, very well done. I mean, this cast is incredible. And I give up all props to them, because I think as an actor, it's got to be really tough to go there and just kind of be naked in a sense. You're just out there by yourself. You're not responding to the dialogue of others. It's not a group scene. It's just very, very much the spotlight is on each person. This is an episode that, forewarned, it pulls on your heartstrings a lot, but I think it earns every single moment of that, because again, it's really based on the connections that people have with Lydia, and also the performances in the writing are so good. So when Elena comes in, she talks about how when she was when she was younger, she actually stopped talking to Lydia in Spanish, and it's the centerpiece of how she felt like that damaged their connection, how she has regrets for that. So we have a clip from that, I think.
Except I screwed myself. Because I lost my Spanish. I lost my connection to you. Then last year it came, and I was so worried to come out to you. And you surprised me with your acceptance and your love and your support. You even helped me get a girlfriend. I know men love you, but you could crush it as a lesbian. So now I feel stupid. Because all I want to do is talk to you.
So that had me in tears. But again, they were really smart about how they paced this. And every so often, a nurse played by Tim Sharp would come in, and there would be a joke about him. And so you would get these little moments of relief. And I think one of the things I like more than anything on television is when a show like Stealth, you know, kind of has a stealth agenda that destroys me in a good way. And Schneider is very much the comic relief, even on a show where everybody is pretty funny. He's kind of this grown-up himbo character, a little bit of a man-child, a little bit oblivious, but he has a good heart. And when he comes in and talks about how important the Alvarez family was to him during his recovery, when he was trying to go clean, that I didn't expect it to devastate me, but it totally did. And let's hear a little of that.
And after I got out of rehab, I started hanging around your apartment a lot more because it helped. Back then, it must have felt like you had this annoying, intrusive guy over. Not like now. Because now, you're my family.
Did not expect Schneider to destroy me, but he totally did. And again, like, terrific performances. Everyone really brought their A game. It was incredible. And, you know, I think one of the things the episode does best is get at the connections that bind people and how terrifying it can be to lose them. And so Justina Machado is incredible on this show. She just is able to do every single thing comedically and dramatically that you would ask of her. But she brings the episode to a whole different level when she goes in to talk to her mom. She actually, this is so smart. It's so good about how parental child relationships actually work. She brings up something she was angry about, how Lydia didn't support her when she was going off to enlist in the army, and she felt very rejected in that moment. And she kind of has all these emotions bubbling around, rage, memories that are both nostalgic in a good way and a bad way. But she's trying to cover up for her deep, deep terror of losing her mom. But in the clip that we're about to play, you hear all of that emotion come out, and it's just amazing.
I'm not going to say goodbye. You hear me, Mommy? Because I understand now why you didn't say goodbye to me when I went to the army, because you were scared I wasn't coming back. And I forgive you. Because now I'm afraid. And I'm not going to say goodbye. But instead, what I'm going to say is this. You did a really good job being my mommy. Because of that, we're going to be okay. I love you so much. But if you need to go, it's okay.
So if you've ever lost anyone close to you, that scene probably left you in a puddle on the floor. And this is a tribute to the show's storytelling chops that I thought maybe they will kill off this character. I would have understood it on an intellectual level. I think it would have made sense. I don't think it would have been a death just to shock people. I would have thought that they did it as, Tara referenced earlier with Jane the Virgin, that there was going to be, I would have trusted they would have played that out in a way that was, you know, in line with their previous writing and characterization patterns, you know. So I could have, I actually was, I screamed a little bit at my television when there's a fantasy sequence, again, something that's very familiar on television, you know, it's sort of a dream sequence. We see Lydia out of the bed. She's dancing with Berto, who's come to collect her. And I thought maybe this character's really gone. And I just, this has been a show for me that in a dark time, honestly, in our country, I watch it and I feel better about the world. I don't feel like they're ignoring the world, but I feel like, oh, if there are people like this in the world, then I feel a little bit better. And Lydia, Rita Moreno, is having so much fun with this performance. It's absolutely infectious, and I would have missed that tremendously. But fortunately, we didn't have that happen, and she has a romantic, beautiful, sexy kind of interlude with her her husband who passed some time ago, who she still misses daily, hourly. So I feel like this episode really went around the, you know, just it just went everywhere. It was grief. It was loss. It was terror. It was anger. It was comedy. It was absurdity. And then it ended up on romance and on hope, because fortunately we did not lose Lydia. If we want to play that last clip.
So, mi amor. Is it time?
Not yet, mi vida.
And that audience was me screaming yes. So that's my nomination. An episode, half an hour of TV can make you feel this intensely when for 2 years it has had solid, empathic, witty, and truly insightful storytelling. I nominate One Day at a Time's episode, Not Yet.
Sarah, why don't you go first?
Okay. My feelings about One Day at a Time in general are on the record. It's just very sitcom-y in the way that I don't tend to like. With that said, so I don't tend to like sit with it or seek it out, except if I'm asked to do so for this, for Extra Hot Grade. But whenever I do, there is something about it that is very endearing, but like also annoying. I mean, sort of just like family. So I have to give them credit for getting that mix of like, oh, Jesus, with the standing back from your punchlines irritation that I feel, but also that these characters, and especially National Treasure Rita Moreno. And I can only imagine, like, every time one of these characters was giving her the speech, except for Alex, of whom more in a moment, it was like, what? Like, you have to go there as an actor, and then National Treasure Rita Moreno is just lying there, like, listening to you. And it, like, yeah. If you're on, like, take four, are you just like, I'm bullshit, fuck this, I quit the show. Like, it must have been extremely difficult, especially for Machado, who is not always my favorite, but I was extremely impressed with her performance in this episode. And, you know, like, you can see it coming. But and yet, like, the way that they get there is really quite wonderful and cathartic, which I think there's, like, it's not the most delicate, nuanced rendition of this situation in the world, but that's okay. I thought it was great. I thought Schneider's segment was great. And I especially thought that Alex, like, this episode had me when he's like, you know, Jesus said that to Peter. Parker, and then just makes the hand gestures. It was just so funny. Elena continues to be an issue for me. I don't know if it's that actor or the way she's written. Like, I think that that character is like important and good to have, but the actor is not quite good enough, I feel, compared to the rest of the cast. But with that said, this was like this was a sitcom serving of comfort food in the best way. And the, not just the evident satisfaction that Moreno took in delivering the title line of the episode, but the audience's like burst of relief that this is how it was going, even though, you know, come on, like, you live in the world and you figure they're probably not gonna kill her off. But it was great. It was cathartic. It was predictable, but sometimes predictable is good. And I really liked it, and was glad to revisit it. Like I said, the show is not really for me, but I always feel like welcomed back into it when I revisit it. So good submission, and it was a nice one to watch, and I'm glad that I've seen it. Tara.
I love the show. And I thought it does, this episode in particular does a lot of things well. I wasn't convinced that they weren't going to kill her off. I thought they might, because, you know, she's obviously, as Dr. Berkowitz puts it in this episode, she's one of the most alive people that any of us will ever see. And yet she's a real old lady. Like, I can see them. I could imagine them trying to get ahead of, like, you know, the possibility that she might die between seasons or between tapings, yeah, or something. And true. Just be like, let's just do this now. But they didn't. I love the Moe's analogy of, like, that it's like verse chorus, the structure of the episode. I also loved Tim Sharp as Nurse Wally when he comes in. Yeah. The clash.
So
between,
hapless.
Yes. But the clash between him and Penelope, where he's like, did you know your mother's a nurse? Because she's told me 500 times. And then he has to admit that he, you know, forgot the saline bag that he came in to change or whatever, and is like, yeah, behind the curtain crying when Elena has her bit with Lydia, because I also forgot that he was in there. Like, that,
yeah.
That was really well done, I thought. And of course, I agree. Justina Machado is perfection. I thought the Schneider thing was, I liked it less than Mo did. And the reveal of the snow globe, I was like, okay, that's a little,
yeah,
much.
That was a little cheesy.
And lighting all the lights, like, there, you know, as when Penelope comes in, she says it's a fire hazard, but it's like, yeah, you can't do that shit in a hospital. Like, sorry, that's silly. Like, it's cute, and it makes a nice visual moment and gives, you know, Penelope the line of, like, Schneider literally built you a stage. Like, it's true, but, you know, it's also silly. But where this episode loses me is, you know, on the trust thing that we keep bringing up, that it's like they didn't trust the episode to work without actually having Lydia active in it. And this is not a show that does fantasy dream sequences like this. And so when we get to her out of the bed in the great dress with her, you know, late husband and stuff, it's like, that's where it loses me. I just felt like it was reaching too much, and it got from heartfelt to kind of corny for the sake of that moment where the audience explodes. Like, I get it, and it is a relief, but at the same time, I wish that it had been allowed to stand with the other performers only, especially since we haven't even talked about the coda after she does live, is she and Schneider get to are sworn in for their American citizenship. and like, it's kind of gets me back with like the family freaking out and singing, you know, doing reprise of like Dolly La Bolita from the premiere, to the point where the person administrating the ceremony has to be like, there are other people. The last line of the season, which is hilarious. But I wish they hadn't done the soul fantasy. Dave,
I wouldn't have mind the fantasy as much. I understand what you're saying, but it's actually, for me, it's the laugh track. And just like half an hour before the show, I had to email Mo. I said, when I clip the last track, do you want me to include the laugh track, you know, the audience reacting to the not yet line or not? Because I just wasn't sure because for me, I kind of wish this show didn't have the audience track in it. I think it would be a better show for it.
It is. They do film it in front of a live audience.
I know
that's
they
not
do.
A laugh track.
But I'm just saying, like, I think it would be better if they didn't.
Right. Yeah, I think it would be less. That's one of the sitcom-y things that gets to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I think, you know, maybe the time has come just to like stop that completely. That's my hot take. The audience reacting to it made it seem more like they were playing to the audience. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that would have been quite as jarring if that wasn't there. And I think like the show is quality and it doesn't need that part. Maybe, you know, it's just part of the sitcom that's part of its legacy and they wanted to have that in there. I guess the one moment I really felt close to Schneider, it doesn't necessarily seem Canadian to me at all in the show as he's written. But the way he cannot do the Stations of the Cross is me. I can never remember what that is.
The sign of the cross.
Or when you do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
and the other part that I thought was just like a little too much was people who crawl into bed with dying people as a sign of sorrow. Always kind of creeps me out. That might be my baggage. But when her daughter gets into bed with her and starts singing, I was like, all right, that might have been a little much for me. Having the pauses for Tobolowsky and the nurse and the priest to come in, you know, lets you catch your breath in between, you know, these poignant family moments. And I think, you know, for everybody who's lost somebody close to you, the specter of losing somebody without being able to have a proper goodbye is sort of like the worst. You know, both my parents died, like I did not get to say goodbye. So that part of it where like she, the daughter is like really kind of having a freak out moment before she just sort of collects herself felt pretty true to me. And then she crawled into bed and then it didn't. But beyond that, I really thought this was a good episode. So with that, let us put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
I think this does everything that the show does well, really well. And it worked on me. Maybe I'm just a sucker for grandpas waiting around long after death for grandmas to be ready, because I feel that happened in my own family. But regardless of Sarah baggage, this is a yes for me. Good presentation. Thank you.
All right, Tara Ariano.
Well, I think because I love the show so much, I have different standards. So this is not one of my favorites. So I'm going to vote nay, but it sounds like it probably does not matter.
Yeah, I'm going to vote yes. I did enjoy it. And I think like it stays true to the show while introducing new elements. I don't think the new elements are wildly outside of what the show, in my mind, is allowed to do. So with that, that is One Day at a Time, Season 2, Episode 13, Not Yet. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great King.
I thought this was a democracy, but I guess this is some kind of dictatorship where people are forced to vote.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
and will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Time for winner and a loser of the week. Who is our winner?
I have our winner. It's the Golden Girls, you know, now and every week. But Ryan Reynolds sent a thank you video to Deadpool 2 attendees in the form of the like a montage of Deadpool 2 scenes cut into the style of sitcom credits. And Thank You for Being a Friend was playing over it. It's pretty funny to see like Deadpool characters giving each other the finger in like hilarious freeze frame sitcom style. While that song is playing, it brought me joy, and we will link it in the show notes.
That's in keeping with his character. He has some sexual attraction to B. Arthur in the comics.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
As do we all, I suppose. Tara. Mm.
Late breaking loser. First of all, side winner, the cast of Arrested Development, no longer the losers of the week because while we were recording. All right. So here's what happened today. It's Tuesday as we record this. Roseanne decided today was the day to get up and tweet Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes had a baby equals VJ, meaning Valerie Jarrett, a former Obama aide. She apologized. Saying she shouldn't have made a joke about Valerie Jarrett's looks, which like true, but only kind of the point, and then said she was going to leave Twitter. And then 1 hour ago, as we're recording this, we got an email blast from the chief of communications at ABC from ABC president Channing Dungey, who writes, Roseanne's Twitter statement is abhorrent, repugnant and inconsistent with our values, and we have decided to cancel her show. Famously already picked up for an 11th season, like right after it premiered. And I on Twitter this morning, people were speculating that the action ABC was going to take would be just be like, well, they'll probably just suspend her and it won't really make any difference because the show's not going to be back until next season anyway. And this way they, you know, can have it both ways. And Channing Dungey's like, nope, fuck her. That's it. Like how you decide this is the line that you draw as opposed to the QAnon stuff or her past anti-Muslim sentiment or Pizzagate or whatever doesn't really matter. Whatever it took for this abomination to be canceled, I am happy about it. And wow, what an idiot. Hope it was worth it. Roseanne.
I wonder if she's still going to throw Halloween parties in her old haunt on the Big Island.
Well, we'll never know.
I just don't understand how ABC didn't see this coming.
Honestly, exactly.
That's on them.
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's why I would love to know, like, I would love an oral history of, like, the decision-making behind both bringing the show back and, like, today's events, because you have to know there were people on the executive level who were like, this never should have happened. I told you.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll light her on fire and stick her up Tim Allen's ass. Girl can dream.
There's a tweet going around about a racist comment that she made about a black woman 5 years ago. So, yeah. I mean, how did you not think this was a thing? Mm-hmm. But I think that it was surprising they did this. I guess that's the time we're living in, that they actually took action, which is not something that networks are really great at when they're making a ton of money from somebody.
Yep. Well, good for them. Good job.
Yeah. Speaking about making tons of money from somebody, you don't know what time it is? It's good time. Oh, I somehow didn't carry over some of the stats from last week, so I am going from memory. I believe this is the sixth game time of the season. And I think season scores are Tara 3, Sarah 2, value guess none.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Correct.
Today we are playing Not Quite Superheroes from Dan Casino, who earns himself an extra credit, redeemable for an extra hot great mini topic of his choosing. Think writes, it may seem like there are superhero TV shows, and there are, but maybe the problem is that there aren't enough of them. Interesting. In this game, we'll tell you the special powers or abilities of a superhero based on an existing character, actor, or show, and you tell us the superhero name. To make things a little easier, each answer will end in man, woman, boy, or girl, or plural forms of those. So, as an example, if I told you she has the power to pull off adorkable bangs, your answer would be...
New Girl.
New Girl is the superhero. There are also hints for each one if you need them. Answer without a hint, 2 points. If you need a hint and you could get the answer after that, 1 point. Make sense?
Yes.
There are 33 questions today, and we have two equalizer opportunities during our score breaks. And of course, we have a tiebreaker if we need it. Tara, steel meal situation, please.
All righty. Sarah DeBunting has 3 steel meals. I have 1 steel meal. Value guests, I regret, are out of steel meals.
Okay. Let's throw it to the person in control, choosing initiative. Picky 3000. It will be first.
We will start with valued guests.
All right. Our order today, Mo, Tara, Sarah, are we ready to play Not Quite Superheroes?
Yes.
Here we go. Mo.
Yes.
He has the power to run a nonstop drug party to cover his guilt over killing Gail. He is...
You can answer Jesse Pinkman.
Pinkman, Jesse Pinkman, correct.
Okay, sorry. How many points for that?
That's 2 points. 2 points for an answer straight out of the gate. If you need a hint, 1 point for the correct answer.
Got it.
Tara.
Yes.
She has the power to leave Brewster, New York, and find fame in the big city. She is...
That girl?
Nice.
Correct. Sarah. He functions as a charisma vacuum, making any role from Seattle murder detective to future body swap guy devoid of any charm. He is...
He is Joel Kinnaman!
Correct. All right, everybody's got their points from the first question. Second question's coming up. He can give Adam Sandler a chance to sing all of his lines during Weekend Update. He is...
Opera Man.
Tara.
Yep.
She can somehow avoid seriously questioning her own privilege after several seasons behind bars. She is...
Piper Chapman?
Correct.
Chapman?
Yes. Okay. Sarah. You must respect his authority. He is...
Cartman!
Mo. He has the power of both criminal and attorney. He is...
Oh, I need a hint.
AMC ongoing since 2015. Also, another show on AMC.
Saul Goodman.
Correct for 1 point. Tara.
Mm-hmm.
This British import heroine can balance her work as a high-end escort with her love life. Sometimes. She is... Remember?
Call girl?
She is Secret Diary of a Call Girl. Yes, correct. Remember, it could be a character or show.
Got it.
Sarah. He can get a nickel every time someone plays the Simpsons theme song. He is... He can get a nickel every time someone plays the Simpsons theme song. He is...
He is... Bartman?
He is... Danny Elfman, the composer.
Oh, yes, Elfman. Good
All right,
question.
Mo, he can make even a bachelor next door take an interest in his welfare. He is...
Hint?
ABC 2014 to 2015.
I don't know. I'm blanking. Sorry.
Anybody?
Mm-mm.
That is the TV show based on the film about a boy.
Oh, that was NBC.
Wow.
NBC?
Yeah.
You might know him from his ability to effortlessly shift between 1,000 voices on Saturday Night Live and The Simpsons. He is...
Hartman.
Bill Hartman, correct.
R.I.P.
Sarah, bring us into our first score break. She can say incredibly racist things in her comedy, but somehow remain lovable. She is...
Ooh. Sarah Silverman?
Correct. Bring us into our first score break. All right, scores, please.
Well, it's a very close game. Mo has 5 points. Sarah has 6 points. I have 8 points.
All right. So, Mo, you are in the equalizer challenge zone. This is how it works. I have in my hand a Trivial Pursuit TV box question from the mid-90s. I'm going to ask you all the questions from it. If you can get half of them right, you get 4 points, double the points available on any one question. Here we go.
Starting
with the classics category. What weekday saw America almost shut down to watch the Milton Berle show starting in 1948? 1 in 7 chance. Oh, no, 1 in 5 chances. The question was, what weekday?
It's going to be a tough one. I'm going to say Friday.
Unfortunately, no. Tuesday. All right.
Damn it.
Sitcom category. What protective device did Allie find in her son's laundry on Kate and Allie? I don't know if device is the right word.
The cup that men wear to play baseball? I don't know. No idea.
A cup?
Or incorrect. A condom?
Yeah.
Close. Right area. Yeah, a condom. All right. Drama. Drama. What series filmed more episodes? Star Trek or Star Trek The Next Generation? You should know this. You love
it. Next Generation. Yeah, of
course. Okay, that's one. Kids and Games is your next category. What daytime TV rating did Family Feud earn in 1977? So what was its ranking, it's asking?
Oh, like number X,
whatever.
Like,
yeah.
Was it the number 2 show in America?
It was even better.
No.
Number 1. Okay, you got 2 questions left. You need them both. This is stars. The answer is usually a celebrity's name. What star rigidly prohibited smoking from the set of Dallas?
Larry Hagman.
Hey!
One question, you get 4 points. It is the wild card category. What was the highest rated syndicated talk show in 1989? Syndicated talk show 1989.
Oh, man.
We're talking daytime talk shows. We're not talking nighttime.
Syndicated talk show, 1989. I'm trying to think of.
When you hear the answer, if you don't get it, you will be mad at yourself.
I'm just going to say. Oh, was it. I'm so torn. Oprah Winfrey Show? No?
Correct.
Yay!
I was almost going to say Maury, and if I had lost on Maury Povich, I would have really punched myself in the face quite hard.
And Maury.
Yeah, I thought it was like, it's either Oprah or Donahue. Okay.
I was going to go Donahue.
Our scores are now, Sarah has 6, I have 8, Mo has 9.
All right, Mo's ahead, and we're back to Mo for the regular questions. This super duo can make a cupcake bar successful somehow in New York in 2015. Together, they are...
Can you read it again? I'm sorry.
This super duo can make a cupcake bar successful somehow in New York in 2015. Together, they are...
2 broke girls.
Correct. Tara.
Yep.
He's only a superhero when Tracy mispronounces his name, but his real superpower is secret knowledge, like the fact that people want food but don't need it. He is...
Oh, no.
When Tracy mispronounces his name.
Yeah. I think it's Greg Grunberg's guy on Felicity, but I can't remember his name, so I don't know. I'm washing out.
Well, do you want the hint?
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Remember the hints? Hint. This character was played by Chris Parnell.
Oh. Spaceman.
Yes. Spaceman. Dr. Spaceman, as Tracy would say. Yes. Good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting. He can star in sitcoms, Aaron Sorkin projects, and Coen Brother movies, and no one ever asks him to lose weight. He is freshly unemployed.
John Goodman?
Correct.
John Goodman.
All right, Mo. Even in her 80s, she can compete on Dancing with the Stars and play a grandma on a bunch of sitcoms. She is...
Is it Rita Moreno?
Nope.
I don't watch Dancing with the Stars. I've just made a terrible mistake.
The hint was, not that it's going to do any good for points. In the 50s, she was on Lassie. In the 90s, on Malcolm in the Middle. In the 2010s, on Raising Hope. That is Cloris Leachman.
Oh, yeah, Leachman. For the hint. Yeah. Stupid.
Tara.
Oh.
Yeah.
He can keep his job without seeming to deliver the mail regularly. He is...
Oh...
He can keep his job without seeming to deliver the mail regularly. He is...
Hint.
Played by Wayne Knight.
Newman.
Newman, correct. Sarah Bunting. She can get all the dirt on the Upper East Side kids without anyone knowing who she is. She is...
Gossip Girl.
2 points. Back to Mo. He can remain a complete drip even when smoking lots of pot in a period sitcom. He is...
Oh. Can I get a hint?
From a 1998 to 2006 Fox sitcom. He is...
Man, that ran for a long time. I should know this. I'm going to tap out. I don't know it.
Anybody know the answer?
Foreman.
Foreman. Eric Foreman. Correct. Arcade. That's a 70s show. Tara.
Yeah.
They can try to make a turn to crime into some sort of women's empowerment show. They are...
Good Girls.
Correct. Sarah. Despite being British and short, his range goes from a bored office worker to a murderous life insurance salesman in the upper Midwest. He is...
Can I hear the clue again? I'm sorry.
Despite being British and short, his range goes from a bored office worker to a murderous life insurance salesman in the upper Midwest. Mm. He is...
He is... Surely a name that I'm going to come up with any moment ending in man. I don't need a hint. I need the answer. Is the hint the answer? It's probably not the answer. And it's not going to be the actor's name, is it? Because that's the answer. Shit. Why don't I stall some more and take the hint? Can I have the hint?
Also played Watson in a recent TV series.
I know that! Why can't I remember his name?
I'll put you out of your misery. That's Martin Freeman. No, poor Sarah. Okay, Mo. Spence. They can wear long-sleeved, flowing clothes and stay comfortable even while layering in Miami. They are...
The Golden Girls?
The Golden Girls. Tara. Yep. Ironically, he's a sitcom straight man who happens to be gay. He is...
Hint.
Role in a recently revived NBC series.
Oh, Truman.
Will Truman. All right. Bring us into our second score break. Sarah. She can start with a manic pixie dream girl role on a sitcom, but maintain a constant TV presence for more than 20 years. She is...
Hint.
Most recently, she's been on Fear the Walking Dead.
I don't know who that is.
That is Jenna Elfman. Jenna Elfman. All right, score sleep.
She was on Fear the Walking Dead?
She's on Fear the Walking... A lot is happening right
That's
now.
That's still on?
I didn't...
Welcome to Trump's America. Okay, Tara, scores please.
All right. Well, Mo and I are tied with 13 points each. Sarah just behind with 10, but she could pull ahead if she gets these 4 points.
Oh! All right. Now you're in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Here are your questions, starting with classics.
Good luck, Sarah.
Thanks.
What Donna Reed show, that's the show, Donna Reed show. What Donna Reed show regular advised? When you handle yourself, use your head. When you handle others, use your heart. Who said that?
Donna Reed.
When in doubt, go obvious. Sitcom. What popular sitcom alien loved rudeness and burping?
Alf?
Drama. What Miami Vice cop sagely noted... People in stucco houses should not throw quiche.
Should not throw quiche?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, for fuck's sake. You know, all right.
The eggs, they get in all the nooks and crannies.
Sure.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
What doesn't make sense is who, well, all right, sadly I could actually name more than one Miami Vice cop. Let's go with Sonny Crockett.
Whoa!
All right, so don't forget, if you get them all, you get double points. So this is like an 8-point swing.
I had not forgotten.
Okay. Kids and Games. What Hanna-Barbera duckling is protected by a bulldog named Chopper? I have no idea what that is. Oh, okay. All right. I've heard of it. Heard of it.
What Hanna-Barbera duckling?
Yeah, duckling is protected by a bulldog named Chopper.
I feel like I can picture this, yeah. But I am just not going to get this. So let's guess. Fuzzy?
No, it is Yaki Doodle. Yaki Doodle.
Oh, okay.
All right, in the interest of time, I'm just going to move it with the game. But
all right,
scores quickly.
Good job, Sarah.
Please, Tara.
Well, now Mo and I still are tied with 13 points each, and Sarah is our better with 14.
Okay, 3 questions for everybody left. So it's anybody's game. Mo. Here is yours.
Okay.
They can talk faster and more coherently, ironic, than anyone in real life possibly could and survive
girls.
In a twee town without murdering anyone. They are the...
Gilmore Girls.
All right. 2 points. Tara.
Yep.
He's behind basically every conspiracy ever. He shot JFK from the grassy knoll. He covered up Roswell. It doesn't make any sense, but roll with it because he is...
Cigarette smoking man.
Correct. Sarah Bunting. He can successfully transition from a kid's sitcom role to adult comedy roles where he generally plays a put-upon everyman, sometimes alongside his sister. He is...
He is... I don't know.
Steel Meal. Go ahead.
She can ask for...
No,
she has an answer. She can get the hint, which you guys are not using, and it's very disappointing.
I retract.
Hint, please.
Recently on a show called Arrested Development.
Bateman.
It took a while. Okay, no. We'll give you that 1 point. Mo.
Thank you.
Their tailored suits can make period misogyny look good. They are the...
Wow.
Their tailored suits can make period misogyny look good. They are the...
Can I have a clue?
AMC 2007-2015.
I should know this.
Probably.
Period...
Tailored suits, misogyny.
I should know this. AMC, why?
An AMC show with tailored suits and jerks who look good.
And it's a period piece. Hung up. Okay. I'm blanking. I should know this.
Steel Meal.
Yep.
Mad Men.
Mad Men. 1 point.
Oh my God. Way to go, Mo. I'm just... Oh, very smart.
When you're in the hot seat during game time, we have a little thing called brain fog. It happens.
It does.
Different
it is
real
to me.
Tara Ariano.
Yes, sir.
She can replace Melanie Griffith with Sandra Bullock and turn a pretty good movie into a terrible sitcom. She is...
Working Girl.
Working Girl. NBC, 1990. Sarah D. Bunting. He can solve crimes and withstand copious amounts of zither music in a TV series based on a classic 1949 film and Graham Greene novel. He is...
What?
Yep.
We're
digging deep back in time on this one, guys.
I'll say I will need a hint.
All right, this is BBC and 1949 to 1955 this ran. Graham Greene novel, classic 1949 film. Seems like it was turned right away into a TV series.
I don't know if this is right, but I mean, what choice do I have? The Quiet Man?
It was the third man.
The third man.
Well, can't be easy. All right, everybody's last question coming up quickly. Tara, what are the scores?
Okay, super duper close. Mo has 15 points. Sarah has 16 points. I have 17 points.
Okay, Mo.
It's pretty cool.
He can romance Linda Hamilton even while dressed like an extra from Cats. He is...
Ron Perlman.
Ron Perlman, yes. Correct.
Wow, nice.
She can take edgy comedy about immigration and assimilation and dumb it down into racial stereotypes in order to please a sitcom audience. She is...
Oh, no. Hint.
ABC... 1994 to 1995.
Fuck! All American Girl.
That is good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting. So long as PAX, P-A-X, is around, she'll be saving us from minor medical maladies in the Old West. She is...
Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman!
Correct for 2 points. All right, let's hear the final scores.
Well, we have a tie. Mo finished with 17 points. Sarah and I are tied with 18 points.
All right, so that means Sarah and Tara are heading into our tiebreaker.
Hey.
Are you ready?
Yes.
No.
The tiebreaker comes to you in the form of... Hot potato. So Sarah is behind in the season standing. So we'll let Sarah go first. You must name superhero TV shows currently on the air. We're talking 2017, 2018. Superhero TV shows. That doesn't necessarily mean all comic book TV shows are superhero TV shows. Keep that in mind. All right. All right. So, you know, I'll just save you the embarrassment of saying Lucifer or iZombie, because those are not superhero
shows. Okay, fair enough.
Okay. Also, if it's been canceled, it's not on the list. Looking at you, Inhumans. Are we ready?
Yes.
Sarah's going first. Go. 19 shows.
Supergirl?
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agents are still a going concern.
Are we counting all TV as TV, like streaming services?
Yes.
Or okay. Luke Cage then.
Iron Fist, the one no one likes.
Jessica Jones.
Legends of Tomorrow.
Oh, good one. God, what is his goddamn name? Why can't I remember his name? Ant-Man. That's not my answer. My mind has emptied of capes and people who can punch really hard.
We haven't even exhausted the Netflix shows yet, guys.
I know.
That's the one she's trying to think of.
I can't remember his name, so I'm out.
Are you actually out?
Yes, I'm out. Wow. I hate hot potato. I've been out.
All right. Somebody's angry. You forgot about certain shows called Arrow, Black Lightning, Daredevil, The Defenders, The Flash, The Gifted, Gotham, Krypton, Legion, The Punisher, Runaways, and even a little show called The Tick. The Tick.
Oh, yeah. Runaways. All right,
that means...
I really only forgot Daredevil, but... Congrats, Tara!
Tara!
Congratulations, Tara. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We watched our 4 monthly free episodes of the New York Times doc... Fourth Estate before paying our respects to Tara's recently deceased DVR and going around the dial with stops at Jane the Virgin, Winona Earp, Killjoys, and Love Means Zeros. Mo made the successful case for One Day at a Time's Not Yet for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week and was the winner of this week's Game Time, putting her in reach of the season victory next week. Remember...
Listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
there are other people.
Sarah D. Bunting.
You can't have a stroke to win an argument, Dave.
And Mo Ryan.
I can't believe how badly I did in that.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Talk Radio.
I kept trying to leave, and then something emotional would happen, and then something even more emotional would happen. You guys are very emotional people. In Pittsburgh, it's steel town, steel hearts.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.